many of you know, international travel has been a passion of mine throughout my entire adult life, and I have both worked intentionally and been fortunate enough to have seen many parts of the world at this point, including significant portions of six continents. Antarctica has been elusive so far, but I hope to get there. And almost all of that travel has been independent rather than using guides or packages, both because it's a lot cheaper to travel that way, and because part of what I enjoy most about travel is the freedom to not only set and change my itinerary, but to simply wander and explore and find my own way and even get lost on occasion. Well, getting lost hiking in the Drakensberg Mountains of South Africa as the sun was going down and the leopards were coming out to hunt was not so great, but it made for a good story that I'll have to tell you another time. Because the point is, I think the biggest difference between being a traveler and being a tourist is the actual travel part between the sights and experiences, like hiking in those mountains, and not the experiences themselves. Now, I'm not deriding tourists. There are plenty of good reasons to be a tourist rather than a traveler. You don't have the time to travel independently, which always takes a lot longer and is far less convenient. You have mobility issues that prevent you from doing that, or you just don't have the patience or endurance or energy to put up with all the uncertainty and craziness that independent travel may require, or you just don't feel like doing it anymore. But the simple fact is, most of my best travel stories are about traveling itself, and not about the sights I was traveling to see, or the experiences that I was traveling to have. For example, some of you have heard parts of my story of taking local buses for about 18 hours across the country of Uganda to go see the mountain gorillas there. The gorillas were amazing to see, but the real story is about the trip that it took to get to them. But I couldn't tell that whole story in a single sermon because there are at least four distinct chapters that each take a while to tell, and all of them together would never relate to just one sermon. You may remember me telling the story in a sermon before of trying to get to that bus at the start of the day when my prearranged taxi didn't show up, and walking out in the road before the sun has come up when a stranger's car pulled over in front of me and I had to decide whether to accept that ride or not. That's the first chapter. But then there's the story of getting on the bus and discovering what the definition of a full bus is in Uganda. And the short version is that it included sitting in other people's laps, on the headrests, or hanging off the side of the bus and standing on the running boards on the outside, in addition to the actual seats. And then there's the story of the bus getting underway and discovering that it wasn't actually going to my destination. The conductor told me it was going near my destination because of road problems, and that they would just drop me as close as they could get, and I'd have to figure out how to get the rest of the way on my own. Then there was the story of finding a pickup truck and riding in it to go those final 30 miles after the bus ride ended over a broken dirt road through the jungle with at least 30 other people crammed in the back of the pickup with me, which resulted in two flat tires and a truck that only had one spare. And then there's the end of the story, which you also may have heard me tell. When I finally arrived at the local campground where I'd be staying in the mountains late at night to discover that the restaurant there had already closed, and I was almost crying from hunger because I hadn't eaten anything at all that day except for an apple and a hard-boiled egg at about 4:30 in the morning. But the manager took pity on me and managed to whip up some spaghetti that tasted like the best pasta I have ever eaten because I was so hungry. So, you see what I mean. Just the summary is, A, still a pretty good story, and B, if I told the whole thing in detail, we'd be here until mid to late afternoon. And that trip was only 18 hours. So I can only imagine the stories that the Magi would have had in journeying from their homes in modern-day Iran all the way to Bethlehem. And we do have to imagine them because Matthew tells us essentially nothing of that journey, and Matthew is the only gospel account that describes them in the first place. But there must have been a lot of stories. There was no package tours that they could have booked back then, no planes or trains or even luxury camels that they could have chartered. So their journey would have definitely been independent travel. And they probably would have been lucky in places to find something as good as a broken dirt road. One of my favorite poems is T.S. Eliot's Journey of the Magi, which I always think of when Epiphany comes around, because in it, he imagines how one of the Magi would have looked back on that journey and described it. He says, "A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year for a journey, and such a long journey, the ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter. And the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out, and the lack of shelters, and the cities hostile, and the towns unfriendly, and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it." As a traveler, I have to say that Eliot's description has a deep sense of truth to it, a truth that we don't often think about when we hear this familiar story in Matthew, because Matthew just doesn't reference anything about the journey other than the simple fact that they took one. In the time of King Herod, he says, "Wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, asking, 'Where's the child who's been born king of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage.'" The actual journey, the travel part of the travels, is completely skipped over. I wonder if there's a reason that Matthew avoided telling those stories, because there must have been some good ones in there. I think maybe it's the same reason that I didn't tell you today about the story of getting lost in the dark with the leopards in the Drakensberg Mountains. Because sometimes a good and interesting and entertaining story can actually lead you away from what's really important, from what needs to be told and heard. For Matthew, that is not the details of the journey that the Magi took, however curious we might be about it. What's important to Matthew is first that they took the journey. That matters far more than the nature of the journey. The Magi might have taken a rickety local bus or flown over on a charter jet. It doesn't actually make a difference to what he thinks is really important, that they came at all. Matthew is the most focused among the four Gospels on the fact that Jesus and his life and his ministry cannot be understood apart from the Judaism that gave them birth. Matthew goes out of his way to explicitly identify Jesus' identity as a faithful Jew. In fact, one of the first things he records Jesus saying during the Sermon on the Mount, his most important and comprehensive set of teachings, is, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets," by which he means the commandments and covenants of God for the Jewish people that are mandated in the Hebrew Scriptures. "I have not come to abolish them," Jesus says, "but to fulfill them." Which is what makes the story of the Magi coming to pay homage to Jesus, which again, only Matthew tells, all the more remarkable and important, because the Magi are anything but faithful Jews. From the language used in the text to describe them, they probably came from the Parthian Empire, which controlled the northern part of modern Iran as well as much of Iraq, which would have ironically included what used to be Babylon, which of course destroyed Jerusalem and took the elites of the Israelite people into exile for several generations, which is told in the Old Testament. But now these magi from that same region are coming, they say, to pay homage to the King of the Jews. And religiously, they're almost certainly Zoroastrian. Zoroastrianism is a religion from that region that worships a god of wisdom, have priests called magi, or wise ones. That's where the word comes from. And those priests are learned in astronomy and astrology. So they would be paying attention to unusual astronomical activity and would have seen that activity as spiritually significant. All of that makes sense. What's unexpected or even shocking is that they felt the need to come and see and honor Jesus instead of just noting it in passing to one another, like, hey, looks like the Jews have got themselves a new king. The way that you and I might have read about the recent presidential election in Chile. But they see it as an event that involves them, something that they should respond to, not simply notice. And by making that long journey and paying Jesus homage, they are making the point that Jesus is not simply the Messiah promised to the Jewish people, but the one who is sent because God so loved the world, as John's gospel puts it, the whole world and all of its peoples, that God sent God's only Son. That's why their visit to the Christ child is worthy of its own annual holiday in the Christian calendar, Epiphany Sunday. Now, the word epiphany means both a moment of revelation and or insight and the manifestation of a divine being. And both of those things are happening in their visit. Jesus' birth is the manifestation of the Son of God in human form. And he's revealed to the Magi as that in their visit, as reflected in their gifts. And indeed, in the sign of the star that they witnessed and discerned the significance of and followed its call in the first place. Now, astrology is not something that most people take very seriously these days. And there are some good reasons for that. A lot of contemporary astrology is little more than petty fortune-telling, with assurances that are so vague that they can be applied to almost anything. A horoscope says things like, an unexpected business opportunity may be coming your way. A new connection may be the seeds of romance, and so on. But human beings have viewed the stars as guides to follow for millennia. They're literally the single most significant resource for physical navigation in the history of the world. And because of that, it's a short distance from that to seeing them as resources for spiritual navigation and using them that way as well. Now, neither Judaism nor Christianity have a spiritual tradition of astrology. So Matthew is not calling us to do that in this story, and neither am I. But that's actually part of the significance of it. God invites the Magi to play a key role in God's telling of his overarching story of salvation for the world, to come and witness the manifestation and revelation of the Christ child, and to do so as the first of those beyond God's covenantal people, the Jews. And God invites them by showing them a sign that connected with their own traditions that they could notice and recognize and respond to in their own context as they were going about their normal life and faith. I think that's the invitation that Epiphany still offers today. The chance to not simply notice or even celebrate that Jesus was born the way we have been for several weeks at this point, but recognizing the all-inclusive importance of that, paying attention to the signs of it as we go about our normal lives, and then responding to them. Epiphany comes early in the Christian New Year and even earlier in the secular one, just a few days after New Year's Day. We're observing it today, but the actual holiday is on January 6th every year, after the period of the 12 days of Christmas. Now, in recent years, many churches have adopted the tradition of Star Words in conjunction with Epiphany, which, as Lindsay said earlier, we're doing this year for the first time. And again, the idea of a star word is that it is a sign to look for as you go about your normal life in your normal context, to see what God is up to in your life and pay attention to it, to guide you in your life and faith and help you respond to the promise and call of Jesus Christ in the midst of it. Now, the words themselves are sometimes simple, sometimes complex, but always rich and provocative. Now, some churches do this practice blindly by drawing words out of a bowl or a bag, but we like the idea of spreading them out, sort of like a constellation of stars, and letting you see which sign you notice standing out to you, calling to you, the way the Magi would have noticed the star for the Christ child. And so that's what we'll do for you and with you as we do this. We'll do most of that next week when we're in person, hopefully once again. And for those of you who continue to worship online, we'll figure out an alternative for that. But the point is to give you a sign to lead you in faith through the year. And the truth is, I think we could all use all the guidance we can get as we struggle to travel through the chaos and confusion of these days in which we find ourselves. And as you do, as you take that star word and look for it in the world, it'll help you connect those experiences with the larger story of God's loving and saving grace that is poured out for us all, every day, and in abundance. That's what Epiphany invites us to remember and claim and live out, so that we ourselves are changed by the experience and brought closer to God in understanding and in action, so that we too can become signs of God's light in the world. Whether our stories are dramatic travelogues or the simple notices in a daily diary of how God's light shines out and calls to us and how we can respond in faith. And may we all be blessed in our journey this year. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.